before the bloodbath begins, slither your way over to the host's socials. For the podcast, slash over to Twitter at the BHO underscore podcast. Instagram, the Baron's Hideout podcast. Then stab over to Dean's Instagram at Dean of the Dead Hot Sauce. Listen to the show on your favorite apps and Patreon. Enjoy the slay and try to stay alive. For the next period of time, strap in as the hosts rip and tear at the unsuspecting guests, in which they learn their dark secrets and methods of the genre. In this bloodbath, no one gets out alive. This is Within the Barons.
Slasher entries, Jason Goes to Hell, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the remake, and also Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3D, which is the one that came after, as well as a bloody fun Christmas massacre movie, Secret Santa. Adam Marcus, and we're here to talk all things Jason, chainsaws, and Christmas. Adam, how are you doing, man?
I'm great, Dustin. Thank you for having me, brother. It's a great Jason Chainsaw and Christmas. That is, wow. That's definitely how, I think that's probably the way my obituary is going to read.
Yeah. I mean, pretty awesome. You've had a crazy, crazy career, which we'll jump into, you know, starting doing a huge franchise at the age of 23.
Yeah.
It's absolutely nuts. So what I want to do is I want to dial all that back before even any of that happened. Where did filmmaking, writing, and all this awesome stuff kind of start with you?
Well, it's kind of a 1-2 punch that happened really at the exact same time. So I have a story that is so similar to so many people that are my age that got into this industry for the first kind of spark of it. Look, my entire family was in the business in some way or another, right? And I was born in New York, raised in Connecticut and Manhattan, back and forth between a divorced mom and dad. And my uncle, Ned Eisenberg, who just passed away a year ago, Neddy was, he played Eddie in The Burning.
Yeah,
Ned is one of those that guys that, you know, everybody knows, oh, that guy, he's that guy. He's every fifth episode of Law and Order, he plays a lawyer or you know, somebody shady and awful, and has had quite a remarkable career. But again, he was in The Burning when I was a kid, right?
Yeah.
My uncle Joe Ellison wrote and directed Don't Go in the House, which famously shared a billboard with Friday the 13th in Times Square. So I was immersed in that side of things. Without a doubt, my brother Kip, who of course is in Jason Goes to Hell and is also my partner when we made Let It Snow, which is our big Sundance comedy hit. He had been on Broadway when we were kids, and then did a TV series, The New Leave It to Beaver for Disney and TBS. So I had all of that, but I'm 9 years old.
Yeah.
And it is the second day into the release of a movie that would change everything. And my dad had already seen it in New York, drove up Saturday morning to take me to the first show. I was like, you have to go see this movie. I'm taking you to see this movie. And there I sat in a theater watching, you know, the Tantive IV being chased by an Imperial Star Destroyer. And that Star Destroyer cruised over my head. And I just went, and I said out loud, I said, I want to do that. Now, my dad, looking at a 9-year old, thought I wanted to be an astronaut. And I went, no, I want to make that.
Yeah.
And, you know, as many people who have the story about Star Wars lighting whatever flame that is, you know, from J.J. Abrams on, that was the moment that I said, I'm dedicating my life to the pursuit of this. And truly, this is not an exaggeration, no hyperbole. I have not spent one day since that day of that 9-year-old sitting in that theater. I have not spent one day of my life not pursuing it. Every single thing I've ever done is in pursuit of that dream. And so I also, at the same time, literally that year, had become best friends with a kid named Noel Cunningham. And Noel's dad, at that point, Noel's dad was really mostly known for the fact that he had made a porn movie.
Yep.
So Sean had made Pornography, which was very like, ooh, you know, everybody was like, all I heard was Sean Cunningham made a movie.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I started pestering Noel about this. And before you know it, Sean had already made Last House on the Left, but people really, really didn't talk about that much back then. That became a bigger deal as time progressed, especially as Wes Craven became more famous. And so I was really excited by the movie aspect of it. Sean started ripping off things like The Bad News Bears by doing Here Come the Tigers, and then Manny's Orphans, which is also known as Kick. And none of that was sticking. That wasn't working. And that's when he turned back to horror and said, you know, this thing, that Last House thing worked really well for me and Wes is killing it, and I'm not. So how do I take what John Carpenter just did and make that happen for me?
Yeah.
And, Victor Miller had a great script that was truly pretty much ripping off Bay of Blood. And they got together, and Sean had a title. Sean had this title, Friday the 13th. The unluckiest day of the year. And much like, you know, John Carpenter, Sean did not want to tell stories of Jason Voorhees. He wanted to tell stories of the unluckiest day of the year.
Yeah.
That was his whole game plan. So I was there for the making of Friday 13th. Oh, wow. Then I was there. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. And then I was there when they went on to make Spring Break. And I apprenticed for his wife, Susan Cunningham, who was like a second mom to me. She was amazing. And of course, Spring Break is like the the least appropriate movie for a 13-year-old boy to be apprentice editing on. Like, it's insane. I always joke, you know, I went in the editing room, a boy came out a man.
Hell yeah, man.
So that was sort of the beginnings of it. But at the same time, I had met a gentleman named Al Pia when I was 11 years old. I actually met him younger than that, but 11 is when I started working with him. And he was a brilliant director. He had worked in New York for forever, and now he had moved up to Connecticut, was running 5 different theaters, including my local high school theater. Now, I grew up in a town called Westport, Connecticut. Westport is one of those, Westport's like this magical little place, right? I went to a public school.
Okay.
The school itself, the building, was built around a theater that already existed. A theater where Jimi Hendrix and the Doors played and Janis Joplin played. They built the school around that because it was one of those communities where the arts mattered more than anything else. In fact, our theater program paid for all of the sports programs.
Wow.
We made hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in support of the school, because we had this, we had a 1400 seat theater, with, you know, full flies and unbelievable proscenium arch and a fully electronic lighting kit. And this is in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, that's wild.
So it's wild. So I started working with this guy, Al Pia. And by the time I was 15, I had created my first of 2 theater companies and was doing my own productions and was running my own shows. So I was directing, I was also acting, and I was a choreographer at the time because I had been dancing since I was a little kid. So it was all this stuff, again, everything in pursuit of the one goal of that dream. And when I was a junior in high school, I was given early decision to NYU, to film school at NYU. Went to NYU. I won Best Picture there for a movie called So You Like This Girl, which is a comedy. And by the way, a comedy starring Tom Lennon and Joe Latruglio of the state of Reno 911 and Brooklyn 99 fame. So I had this like unbelievable cast. We won Best Picture, and we also won a special award, which had never been given before, which is the Ensemble Award. So my entire cast was awarded for the film. I got two job offers, one from David Lynch and Mark Frost to write for season two, to be in the writer's room for season two of Twin Peaks.
That's crazy.
It's crazy. And the other offer was from Sean Cunningham, who said, quote unquote, come to LA and be my bitch for a year and I'll give you your shot. Those are his words.
Wow.
And I said, I'm going to LA. Like, I'm going to go do this. I'm going to go make a movie. And I came to Los Angeles. I had $300 in my pocket and no driver's license, which is a terrible way to show up in Los Angeles.
Yeah. And especially terrible, that time.
The worst. But I also had a screenplay that I'd been workshopping with my closest friend in college, a guy named Dean Laurie. It was a screenplay called Johnny Zombie. And I very swiftly started, you know, pitching that at events. I would crash charity events that friends of mine from NYU were now in catering in LA, trying to make their dreams come true. And they would sneak me into events and I would dance with, you know, powerful women and try to get them to help me make a movie. And I got some bites. And the minute I got bites, I told Noel, knowing full well he would tell his father.
Yeah, yeah.
And he did. And next thing I know, Sean demands to read the script. I let him read it. He hated the script, but he loved the title and he loved the idea of the movie. So he said, I'm going to give you $1.5 million and you'll go shoot this up in Connecticut. I'll send you back to Connecticut. You shoot this movie. And I was like, we're going to what now? Like, it was like,
I just came all the way over here.
Right. It was like, that's okay. Yeah. Okay. He says, but I want to get a real writer on this. I'm going to, you know, fire your friend. We'll buy it from him. And then I was like, no, then I don't want to do it. And yeah. Again, I was 21 telling Sean Cunningham, no.
Yeah.
Like, it was your dream. I don't want your $1.5 million if you're going to fire my friend. And he looked at me like I was like, what species was I? Like, he didn't get it at all. And I said, you know, fly Dean out to LA, put us up in the cheapest, most ratty motel you can find, and give us a few weeks to rewrite. And we'll do whatever you want to the script. Like, we'll work with you. Like, let's make it happen. And he did. He actually fell for this whole thing. At the end of the 6 weeks, he fell in love with the script and hired Dean Laurie as the first and only staff writer Sean Cunningham ever had. Johnny Zombie ended up getting bought by Disney. It went into a bidding war between Disney and New Line. It was great. And I was Sean's slave at that point.
Yeah.
I had worked it out. We were going to send the script out for people to read. And I was like, Sean, you keep telling me that nobody in our industry reads anything. And you're going to hand them this like weird zombie comedy thing that they're not going to know what to do with. It's a hard R, but it's a comedy and it's teenagers. And it's not what anyone was making at that point. I'm like, they're not gonna get it. He said, well, what do you want to do? I said, why don't we read it to them? And because of my background in theater, and Sean had a very rich background in theater. Sean was the stage manager of Wait Until Dark on Broadway. Wow. So, you know, he knew what I was trying to do. We ended up getting an incredible cast of mostly Broadway, either Tony winners or Tony nominated actors. We had people like Charlotte Ray and George Hearn. People who had literally won the Tony, and the person who played Johnny in our reading of Johnny Zombie was Adam Sandler.
That is so wild.
Who had lived next door to Dean and I for the last 3 years at NYU.
Wow, dude, your life.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Wow, man.
Yeah. Yeah. There are times when I'm like, did that happen? And yeah, it did. So we got into a bidding war and I begged Sean to go with New Line. I was like, New Line's totally going to know what to do with this movie. And Disney had a big truck of money pull up. And that was that. Sean has never, ever, ever said no to the money, ever. So wherever the money is, that's where Sean's going to go. So he went with the money, which I understand it. It was the wrong creative decision, but I get it.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were going to make, you know, an $8 million movie, and they were going to Disney-fy it. And suddenly it was a PG-13, not a hard R. They were cutting everything from this movie. I mean, they were just neutering it. And I said, you know, first off, they were never going to let a 22-year-old direct this movie. That was never going to happen. So I let them go off and do what they did. I was an associate producer on the movie. It was my first credit. I was 21 when the movie got sold, which was amazing. And I said, Sean, you owe me a movie. And he said, all right, well, New Line's going to buy Jason Voorhees from Paramount. So if you can figure out a way to get that fucking hockey mask out of the movie, I'll let you write and direct it.
That's actually a question I was going to ask you, if that was actually a true quote, because I know that's
passed around a lot. That is a true quote. That is a true quote. Yeah. Sean loves to say that it's not true. So I always posit this to people about that. Okay. Sean calls me a liar basically over this. Yeah. Okay. So there's one of two scenarios here. So I'm 22 and I'm standing in front of Sean S. Cunningham. Okay, the guy, the creator of the Friday 13th franchise, yep. The creator of the House franchise, he's that guy, right? The guy who unseated Empire Strikes Back from its theatrical number one spot with Spring Break. Okay, that Sean Cunningham. And me, a 22-year-old, one of two things happened, and I'll take either one. So either I said, Sean, listen, I want to do a Friday 13th movie, but I want to get rid of that goddamn hockey mask. I mean, who needs that anymore? Like, isn't the audience bored of the hockey mask? So we're going to get rid of that. Well, Adam, I mean, I think that the fans really love Sean. I know what I'm doing. So why don't you just sit there and look pretty, and I'm going to get rid of the hockey mask, which makes me the single most powerful 22-year-old on planet Earth. And if you've ever met Sean Cunningham, no one tells Sean Cunningham what to do about anything. So let's say I'm going to take him. So either it's that, or the other route is that Sean Cunningham said, get rid of the fucking hockey mask. And I went, you got it, boss. And I went off and did that, which means I was a good soldier doing what I needed to do to get my first movie made.
Yeah.
Which makes me a responsible employee of a powerful filmmaker. So, so either Sean is a eunuch that I overpowered at 22 years old, or Sean Cunningham is the fucking liar. So which one of those is true? By the way, I'll take either. I'm happy to take all the responsibility if you want to say that I wrestled Sean Cunningham to the ground and said, I'm doing this with your franchise. Take it.
Yeah, like a very, very late entry of it, too. But you being right. So young, that's no.
Right. And literally, like, I'm sitting in the office and Sean's like, everybody hated part eight. It's fucking stupid. We're going to forget that movie happened. You're going to start from part seven, but get rid of the fucking hockey mask. And I'm like, okay, boss. Like, I'll do what you need me to do. I was psyched. And again, I love those movies. Now, was I frustrated with the way that those movies were going? You bet.
Oh, yeah.
You bet. As was the whole fandom. Everybody was bored, you know? And they weren't reinventing the formula. They were going like, it's the same movie you just saw, but this time he fights Carrie. Or this time we're going to put him on a boat and we're going to put him in one shot in actual New York. The rest will be in Montreal. Sound good? I mean, we were all tired. Right. And Jason Takes Manhattan was like, remember when that teaser came out? It was just a shot of Jason on the Jersey Shore looking at the skyline of New York. And they played New York, New York as they pushed in on him.
Oh,
and I was like, oh, my God, this is going to be the best movie ever. And then we took a boat ride from the middle of New Jersey, which is landlocked.
Yeah.
So
pretty wild.
So again, I was, you know, look, I was excited. I was excited to jump in. I was excited that, look, you know, most filmmakers say they hate when people put parameters around them or you know, roadblocks. I think that's bullshit. I like when a studio says, here's what you can do, here's what you can't do. Because then I know where the lanes are, and I go, great, now it refines your story before you even go in to tell the story. So I wrote a treatment for the movie. Everybody really liked the treatment. The problem is the treatment had body hopping in it, but the treatment was very, very dark. It was not the movie we ended up with. It was a super dark, more sort of Dario Argento kind of inspired movie. Super gory, which, by the way, the movie as is super gory. It's the goriest movie in the franchise. But it wasn't just that. There was an anger to it. Because again, I was a 22 angry year old. I was a 22 year old angry young man.
For sure.
Totally. So it was angry. That said, it was about more adult characters because I was like, well, I represent the audience of Friday the 13th. Like, I was the right guy. So I'm going, look, I'm older now. And honestly, to watch kids take off their tops and get slaughtered at the camp is losing its charm, mostly because our audience has aged out of that. Can we give them something more interesting? Can we give you people with lives? Here's the other thing. And it really sums up everything I feel about Jason Goes to Hell and also about franchise filmmaking in general.
Okay.
By the third part of almost every franchise, the monster becomes the hero, which means it's no longer a horror movie. It's something else, but it's not a horror movie. Because the problem is, no one roots for the shark in Jaws. No one. Okay, in the first Friday 13th, you weren't rooting for the killer. In the second Friday 13th, because it was a new killer, it was a whole different ballgame, you still weren't rooting for him. By part three, he becomes the Marvel superhero.
Yeah,
I agree. And now you're writing paper-thin characters because you don't want the audience to be upset when they go. You want just things you can knock down, and it's like, woo! Oh, you use the weed whacker. Yeah. And I get, but they become wrestling movies. They're just wrestlers now, right? And you have your favorite bad guy wrestler. That's what they become, right? Yeah. So for me, it was like, how do I tell a story with the same guy, but give it a little bit of its creep back, give it back some of its scare? And it's funny because a lot of people thought that, like, you know, we referenced The Hidden. By the way, completely accidentally, I had not seen the movie The Hidden. I had not seen that film. I've seen it now, and I love it. And I also go, I totally get why people think that we were cribbing off that movie. But remember, I made that movie at New Line. There's not one executive, not one person who said, Adam, you should look at The Hidden. No one ever said it. And they made the movie. That's Jack Shoulder's movie, who helped make that company with Bob Shea. So no one ever said anything. By the way, when Jack Shoulders saw Jason Goes to Hell, his response to was, I'm going to take it as an homage. And I was like, good for you.
Oh, wow.
I was like, there you go. I like that. That's awesome. Here's the thing. My film is more reaction to John Carpenter's The Thing than it is anything else. And my filmmaking and Secret Santa in a big way, I'm constantly referencing The Thing, because for me, what Carpenter created in that film was this sense of who goes there, which is why it's so wonderful that he was able to adapt that short story, that sense that we can't trust anybody. And so I love that idea. And I was like, what happens when you're Jason? What happens when, and by the way, the other part of it is once he leaves your body, you suddenly, you know, fall to pieces, literally.
Yeah.
Because of that much concentrated evil, the body can't support. So it's why we did the Melty Man routine. Like, that's why that's in there. Which, by the way, that's inspired by Time Bandits, by the last shot of Time Bandits. When the parents touch concentrated evil and explode, I was like, that's Jason. Like, that's my version of Jason, is that concentrated evil. So the movie is a lot of references. It's also a love letter to all the movies I grew up loving. And that's, you know, that's kind of how we got to Jason Goes to Hell and why I did what I did.
That is such a crazy story. Why haven't written a book, have you? Because
no, I actually am writing a book, but I will say, look, dude, we are just about done with the Jason Goes to Hell documentary, Hearts of Darkness, The Making of the Final Friday.
Hell yeah. Hell
we're
yeah.
finishing that up. Literally, we just sent it to to our lawyer, Larry Zerner, to do the legal work on it. And then it's locked and we're ready to go. So yeah, we're days away.
That's awesome. I'm really, really excited for that.
Oh, good, man. But, good.
Yeah, like I said before we started doing this, like this whole like thing going on right here is such a pinch me moment because I grew up, you know, watching all the Friday the 13th films. And I have a son now too who's 5 who
watches awesome.
Like more behind the scenes type things sure. than like the sure. actual movies, but like, he knows yeah. like all the characters and whatnot. And I really want him to go through all the films once he's ready for it.
Sure.
And I know Jason Goes to Hell was always that mm-hmm. one that everybody's like, yeah, you can probably skip on that one. But ooh. I was never really ooh. Like that. And just as of, I want to say maybe the last like couple of years, mm-hmm. there's been like sort of a resurgence, at least in like my friend circle, that everybody yeah. is talking about Jason Goes to Hell now and how great yeah. it is because it takes, you know, the franchise in such a different direction. Yeah, people were mad that Jason wasn't right in front of your face. But I like the refreshment. I like watching films that, you know, put a spin on something that make you yeah. love the franchise again. And that's exactly what you did. And I know at the time that it didn't really make a lot in the box office because of everything going on and, you know, Jason not really there and critics were also slamming on it. But to see like a resurgence now, I feel like is amazing. And you must thanks, be man. Like if you're even seeing any of this, like wow, people are finally understanding yeah. my film now.
We had it was actually an interesting opening of the movie because here's the funny thing, and you know, Rotten Tomatoes didn't exist then.
Yeah.
The movie was actually better reviewed than almost any other Friday the 13th movie when it first came out. New York Times gave us a great review, Washington Post gave us a great review. We got some great reviews, right? So much so that my first two job interviews the week after the movie opened, my first one was sitting with Francis Ford Coppola at Zoetrope at Sony. And my second one, I was flown to New York to meet with Robert De Niro and his production company. So, so I was, you know, immediately after the movie, there was really some success. The other part of it is, the movie had made more money at the box office than the previous movie had made at the box office. And we were made for less than half of what that movie was made for. So when people realize like how low budget Jason Goes to Hell is, I mean, it is a tiny movie. We made our movie for way less than all the other sequels, way less. So, but it's also because Sean Cunningham, look, my problems with him aside from, you know, as a human being, as a producer, as a line producer, Sean's brilliant. Sean knows how to shove 10 pounds of shit in a 2-pound bag. Like, he knows how to do it. He also knows how to get anything a director needs to make the day happen. Like, he does understand that. It's just the sad thing about Sean is that as a person, his level of encouragement is not great. So that was not good. That was rough. That was rough yeah. to have to deal with. But I have to tell you, I mean, he knew how to produce the movie. So, and I'm grateful. And look, he gave me my career. So I, you know, God bless him. I love the guy for that. That's amazing. I just wish Sean's one of those guys that I just wish could be as good a human being as he is a producer. You know, but at the movie didn't, and remember, we didn't have the internet the way we have it now, right? True. The internet was dial-up back then at best, and there were only a few people who had it. You had to listen to that ring, ring, ring forever, right? But here's what it was. There wasn't this wave of hate. That came later. Because once the internet happened and once YouTube happened, there was this joker who made a video called How New Line Cinema Destroyed the Friday 13th Franchise. And suddenly, whew, I mean, I would go to conventions and there would be guys who truly like wanted to fight me.
It's just and a be film, like, everybody. Remember that.
Right. And by the way, to that end, look, here's the thing. And if you follow me at all, you'll know this. I follow the Johnny Carson idea of ways to deal with fans. It takes just as long to be kind and respectful and take a moment for somebody as it does to be an asshole. True. It's just the same amount of time and energy. And so I try to engage with anybody who wants to engage with me. By the way, that includes the haters. So there are people who come at me like full guns blazing, right? And if someone just has like a dislike of filmmaking wise, I go, okay, well, there's nothing I can do. Sorry you didn't like it. Cool. But if somebody's wishing me ass cancer
or telling me
how I raped their childhood, that's the moment when I go, hey, bro, listen. What happened to you?
Yeah.
Like, this isn't about my movie. I know it's not about my movie because my movie isn't that powerful. Like, I'd be giving myself way too much credit if this affected you that badly.
Yeah.
Like, who hurt you? Like, what happened, man? What's incredible is that when you disarm someone and make them, some of them just tell me to go fuck myself. I'm like, okay, cool. But get some help.
Yeah.
Like, please.
Yeah.
Those people who stop for a moment and want to talk to me, we start talking, we'll talk about the film. You know, I don't have to talk about their personal life or their childhood, but we'll start talking about the movie. And within about 5 minutes, you know, I go down the line of like, well, okay, so who's your favorite Jason? Well, Kane Hodder. Okay, well, he's the guy who did Jason Goes to Hell. What about the look of Jason? Oh, it's pretty badass. I mean, I kind of like looked at the, you know, the skin is coming around the mask. Like, okay, cool, cool. Did you like Creighton Duke? Oh, second best character in the franchise. Cool, cool. Or third best under, you know, Jason, Tommy, and then, you know, and then Creighton. I'm like, okay, great, 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 great. How about the effects? You like the effects? Yeah, badass. The effects are awesome. How about the music? You like Harry Manfredini? Oh, no, no, no. It's a really good score. Like, it's an underrated score, really good score. Okay, would you put like the kill in the tent? Would you put that in the top five of kills? Oh, no, 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 that's number one. Like number one or number two, either the sleeping bag death or the girl in the tent. Like it's those are the shit. Okay. So what's the problem?
Yeah. It's like, oh,
well, I mean, Jason's not in the movie. No, no, no. No, Jason's in the movie. And by the way, did you know he's in the movie in mask longer than almost all the other films? Like yeah, on screen true. In mask.
That is true.
And then there's other people who are still Jason. So Jason's in the whole movie. He's just not wearing the hockey mask. And I bet you like part two where Jason's dressed as the Elephant Man. So you've liked Jason when he wears other costumes before. You just don't like these costumes. So is that the problem? Is it purely and all we get down to is, there's not enough hockey mask. Okay, cool. Cool.
I mean, like, that's cool. But
that's fair.
Go watch all the other films, too. You know, it can make up for that. But, like, I don't know. I just think it's a great film for really putting something so different. Like, I feel like every slasher series or franchise, whatever you want to say it, I think they need to go and do something like that. Like, obviously, Halloween, they tried doing something with that, and they got slammed for it.
Yeah.
And then they're like, okay, well, we have to bring back Michael because no one's watching our films now. They brought back Michael. Freddy got way too much of a jokester. So everybody started watching it because he's funny. And then with Jason, like you were saying before, it's just rehashing the same thing over and over again. Go to camp, kill kids, then die.
Rinse and repeat. Yep.
And then we get to your film where, okay, his Jason, the whole beginning of the film is so suspenseful. There's so much going on. Then he gets blown to pieces. You're like, I don't think I've ever seen that before in any of these franchises. And then he comes back, obviously, through people eating his heart, which I think is so badass. And then body hopping, which is awesome. And then you can, he's still there when people look in the mirror, like you can see him.
Oh
right
yeah,
there.
He's still
he's
there. He's still Jason.
And I think it's just, it's so cool what you did. And people who, you know, go to attack and say you ruined it, I feel like they're taking it all wrong. In fact, you gave it a whole new wave because after this one, we went right back to essentially the same thing he was doing before.
Same
but
thing.
In space.
Same thing. Yep.
You know?
Yep.
And then we have all the fan films that are coming out, which I wanted to ask you about your thoughts on those.
Yeah.
That obviously they're kind of doing the same thing, but they're putting him in like different areas, which I think is really cool.
Sure.
Like in snow, sure. Or whatever it may be. But you just really did something so different that I think people need to really go back and rethink it. Like, you know what? Adam made a kick-ass Friday the 13th film.
Thanks, man. Thank you. I appreciate that. I really do. That's awesome. Yeah, we look, you know, even when you look at, when you say, you know, Freddie became funny. And again, it goes back to what I was saying about how the villains become the heroes all of a sudden.
Yep.
You know, that broke Wes's heart. That killed Wes. Wes hated what happened to Freddie. He hated it. So much so, he made New Nightmare as a reaction to it, which was, yeah. I made up a character. You've made him too much a part of pop culture. And that's dangerous. Because it is. We can't start thinking of the villain as the hero. That's a bad move. We start to blur the lines of what wrong and right is. And, you know, these killers are not right. They're just not. No. They are sociopaths. They are the bad guy. And if we keep blurring that line, we keep making it totally okay for people to act out in a terrible way. And I got to tell you, you know, I know Wes. I know Toby Hooper. I know a lot of these guys who have made some of the scariest, craziest movies, George Romero. They're all pussycats. Like, they're nice people, really nice people. They excise their demons through these stories. They get rid of all that stuff, right? And you end up like Stephen King is a sweetheart.
Yeah.
But that's because the darkness goes into the work. And the whole idea of that is to release all that crap, not to take it in, not to become that. And by the way, I'm not talking about people who cosplay and say, that's awesome. Like, I love that.
No, people who are doing real life bad things.
right. Exactly. Yes. And so, you know, I always want and you know, I've never believed that horror movies inspire badness, but I think there is a breakdown for people that takes away some of their empathy.
For sure.
And that's the problem, you know? So look, in Jason Goes to Hell, I wanted you to like the people in the movie. I wanted you to relate to them. I wanted it to be that all these people are in the water and the shark is coming.
Yeah.
And you don't know who the shark is. That was for me the fun of it. So, you know, that's Jason Goes to Hell in a nutshell.
Yeah, that's so awesome hearing that whole story. And then you did that and then you moved on to do Texas Chainsaw Massacre. How did that happen?
Well, I did, you know, I did Texas Chainsaw. We weren't allowed to have Massacre.
That's true.
Because of the school shootings. The thing about Texas Chainsaw, so right after Jason Goes to Hell, I got offered a ton of sequels. Like, everything was a sequel. Amityville 97. seriously, like, it was, you know, Leprechaun Back to Da Hood, you know, like Pumpkinhead 2, like all these movies. And I turned everything down and I just went, I don't want to be a guy that has a number at the end of every movie he makes. Like, I can't do it. And look, Jason Goes to Hell doesn't have a number. So I was never the guy who had a part number at the end of his movie. So I wanted to do original work, and my wife and I started writing together at that point because I met her during post on Jason Goes to Hell. And in fact, my wife is, I brought her in because Sean didn't want to pay for the actors to come back and do their ADR. So he was going to pay my girlfriend some money to come in because she's an actress and do the ADR for all the women in the movie.
That's right. Really
cool. So all of the screaming, all of the panting, all of the running and falling, all of that, that's all Deb.
Of that is Deb. Congrats.
Yeah. I'm the voice of Jason because he didn't want to bring Kane in. So Dean Laurie is the voice of several of the soldiers and the, you know, that blow up Jason. So, I mean, literally it was like anyone who was there jumped in to do the voicing on the movie.
It's like so indie for being a quote unquote big budget film. That's nuts. Yeah. Wow.
Yep. So I had done all this stuff, and my brother Kip was on Broadway in Les Mis at that time. He's playing Marius on Broadway. And he had written a play that he brought to me, and he wanted to make it into a movie. And it was so diametrically opposed to everything I was getting offered in Hollywood that I went, yeah, Yeah, this is cool. Like, yeah, I'll go do a romantic comedy with you in Brooklyn. Let's do that.
Hell yeah.
So I go off and I make Let It Snow with my brother, and the movie becomes this like weird festival darling, and we become a hit at Sundance. And the next thing you know, I'm writing a ton of television. Kip and I sold 5 series in 1 season. And at the same time, my wife and I are writing horror movies and selling them. Like, we sold a lot of horror movies. Literally every studio in town had one of our scripts on the
That's so awesome.
on their shelves. Yeah, it was amazing. I was very lucky and worked my butt off. And so Deb and I were writing all this stuff. My brother and I are doing all this television. And after we sold several scripts, we ended up at a place called Evolution Entertainment, which was the partner company of Twisted Pictures.
Okay, yeah.
And that's when there was a producer for Twisted who loved Dev and my work. And it was a script in particular, a script called Gravity that had been on the blacklist for years, for decades at that point. Gravity was actually getting made at the time by a South African filmmaker, got turned into a movie called Momentum that stars James Purefoy, Olga Kurylenko, and Morgan Freeman. So that was being made. We were producers on that. And then this guy from Twisted said, "Hey, Steve Susco just wrote 2 drafts for Lionsgate. Lionsgate is throwing out the drafts. They're pissed. They don't like what he did." And he kind of gave them the finger a little bit, which was hilarious and awesome. And I love Steve. Steve is such a madman. I love the guy. So he totally pissed off Lionsgate. They threw out his drafts. We couldn't even look at the drafts. And we were told, "We need you to come in and pitch." So we went up against 17 other writing teams.
Jeez. Wow.
But what I did, what Deb and I did, was we sat down and we wrote a 15-page treatment for the movie and the first 11 pages of the screenplay and
Okay.
handed it to them. And they hired us like that. And they were on a time clock. They needed to get the movie made. So Deb and I immediately started writing. And Lionsgate is amazing. Like, I'm very blessed that I've made movies with both New Line and Lionsgate. New Line in its heyday, Lionsgate in its, because they are both incredibly creative, releasing based companies. It's all about marketing. Like, everything they do is about understanding that horror audience. They get it. And they also love horror movies. Like, they actually love horror movies, right? So we started working with them. We did a draft, and they had a lot of changes they want to make, like a lot.
Of course.
Our producer from Twisted loved the movie as it was written, right? But here's the thing. There's a studio that's going to give us $20 million to go make a movie. We'll do the changes. We'll make it work. We're going to make everybody happy. That's a writer's job, is going, "Okay, what do you guys want? What do you guys want?
Yeah.
Great, let's make it all happen." Right? And that's our job. Our job is to kind of stitch together everybody's feelings and thoughts and put it into something where everybody's cool with it, right? The producer from Twisted lost his shit. Like, would have temper tantrums
Oh
and
no.
screaming at people and crying at business lunches. I mean, dude, it was just awful and embarrassing. And ultimately, Lionsgate said, "We're not going to make the movie. We'll release it, but we're not going to pay for it. So you go out and find financing, and we'll put out the movie."
Oh.
Well, this guy now is running around town trying to put his movie together. So Deb and I wrote a $20 million movie that he only had $8 million to produce. And,
Tough situation.
well, the worst. And also, he wanted Deb and I to come in and do free rewrites on the movie, but our bonus for writing the film was based on the budget. So now we're being told, "Come in and write for free and cut your bonus more than in half by doing it." And I was like, "Wait." And my response was, "I hear you. It's business. This happens. Fine. All I ask is that you guarantee we had these preliminary box office bumps in our contract." I said, "Guarantee the bumps and we're good." And the guy told us to go fuck ourselves.
Oh, no.
I was like, wait a minute. I'm saying we'll write for free. Wait a minute. You're not going to pay us. The audience is going to pay us. What is wrong with you? Right? And by the way, our manager is at the same company yelling at the producer going, are you out of your mind?
Oh, my God.
Right. Right. So then they hire John Lusenhop, who loves the script and wants Deborah and I to come back and do rewrites, and the producer won't allow it. So the director hires Kristen Elms, because John Lusenhop isn't a Writers Guild writer, so he can't write on the script. So he has to get somebody who will write on the script. And now she's putting in his stuff that he wants in the movie. Fine. It's what happens on every film. We get it. But we wrote a movie that took place in 1993. You know how I know that? Because we wrote in the town square of the town.
Yeah.
Jason Goes to Hell is playing at the movie theater.
Hell yeah.
So it's 1993. There was no smartphone scene because we didn't have, you know, Marty McFly didn't come back with a smartphone. And no one ever said, do your thing, cuz... That didn't happen. We also had incredible sequences that got cut. Like, dude, there was a scene with a stampede of 1,000 head of cattle with Leatherface walking through the cattle with the chainsaw and all of this in 3D.
Whoa.
No, the movie was insane.
We need to make this
happen. Kidding. No kidding, man. That script was so good. Deb and I booked 4 movies off of just the screenplay before that film even got released.
Wow.
We'd booked 4 other projects. So but this is working in the studio system. So we made that film. Then our film Momentum got made, which we were producers on, but we really didn't have a lot of control because that's not what happens. And it got to a point where Deb and I just were like, man, this sucks. Like, yeah. It's great making money and the studios are awesome for that. Like, and we were well paid and all of that was great. But at some point you want to make things that you go like, no, I'm really proud of this movie and it's every word I wrote and it's what I care about. And I was consulted and treated like a filmmaker rather than just like, oh, go get them for a month and then we'll move on.
Yeah.
And so at that point, we spoke with our best friend, a guy named Brian Sexton, who was a producer, associate producer on the film I had made previously, my Val Kilmer epic Conspiracy.
Yeah, that's a great movie.
Thank you. Thank you, man. It was the hardest movie I ever shot, and Val Kilmer is the devil.
I hear a lot of stories.
Well, dude, he kicked me in the nuts day 6 on set.
Oh, my God.
Laid me out on set for no reason. For literally no reason. He bought a new pair of Crocs and wanted to show them to me, and I said, hang on a minute, Val, and I turned, and he literally kicked me in the nuts. He thought I could see with my testicles.
Oh, my God.
A true story. We met this guy, Brian Sexton, on that set. And over the years, he became our closest friend. And he was really unhappy at his job in that same company that made the Val Kilmer movie. And we were really unhappy. And we were like, why don't we make things that we believe in? Why don't we make stuff together? And we formed the company in 2015. And Brian was at AFM. At the American Film Market in Santa Monica, and nobody had any horror movies, and people were clamoring for horror films.
They always
so
are.
Brian, they always, because we always make money.
Yeah,
we're the money making machine. So he calls us, is like, look, we need a horror film. We need it right now. What do you guys have that we can shoot for nothing? And we had some found footage stuff that we had been working on, but I was like, I feel like that market's drying up, Brian. I feel like there's too many people in it. I said, I think we need a more traditional horror movie. He's like, okay. I said, I don't know if we have anything, but let me figure something out. Give me a minute. Now, by the way, he called us, this is true story, on Halloween Day.
That's so awesome.
So October 31st, he calls us for this thing. I immediately call one of my closest friends, a woman named Pat Destro. Now Pat is part of the Skeleton Crew Theater Works troupe. Now, Skeleton Crew is the name of our company, but Skeleton Crew Theater Works is my theater company here in LA. And I teach 3 classes a week, 2 live and 1 on Zoom every week And I have for 30 years. I've been doing that for 30 years.
Wow.
It is my lifeblood. It's my favorite thing. So I called this woman, Pat, who's one of my students. Now, Pat, very cool lady, her and her husband, Bob Cox, they had a company, they've sold it since. They had a company, they made the set for Big Brother. They built the Big Brother house.
Oh, wow.
They built Hell's Kitchen. They do all of these like big reality show sets. That was their thing, right? So they had made good money over their lifetimes, and they bought this amazing place on Big Bear Lake, right? It was actually a small house that they turned into a mansion. And they foolishly, she told me when we were up there to visit them, hey, if you ever need the house for shooting, you know, love to let you shoot here.
All right.
So I called her up and I called her up and I said, this is years later. And I said, Pat, remember when you told me I could shoot at your house? She's like, absolutely. I said, okay. So I want to know, can I have the house for the first 2 weeks of January? She's like, yeah, no problem. We're not going to be here. I said, great. I said, but I need you as well, because I have a part that I want to do for you. She's like, awesome. I'm in. Great. I said, can you do me a favor? Check the two houses on either side of you, because I know they Airbnb those houses. See if I can rent them for those 2 weeks. And can you ask everybody in your neighborhood if they can leave up their Christmas decorations until Martin Luther King Day? She's like, I'll call you back. Give me an hour. I said, great. She calls me an hour. She goes, you got the two houses and they're giving them to you for a friend price. I was like, great. And everybody's going to keep up their Christmas lights.
That's awesome.
I'm like, okay. So now I have my location to shoot. I've got where I'm going to put my cast and my crew, and I'm set dressed. Haven't even put one word on a piece of paper yet. So I call Brian. I said, we got a movie. Give me a couple weeks. Let me get a script. Deborah and I write a script in 20 days. The first draft of Secret Santa was 20 days. We do a reading. I don't even let Brian look at it. We do a reading in 20 days after we start writing. The cast all come in and they're like, what is this script? Like, nobody knew what I was doing. Like, this is nuts. What is this movie? Because I told them it's a horror film, right?
Yeah.
But the tone, they were like, I don't know what the... So I said, trust me, everybody sit around the table. We're going to read. So we shoved that entire cast, a big cast, into my friend Michelle Lair, who's in the movie, plays Jacqueline, who's right behind me right now, this lovely lady in my photograph. So we're at her kitchen table, which we've added two tables to, and we are shoved in, right? We do the reading, and people within, by page two, people are cracking up. And they're like embarrassed. And I'm like, no, it's a comedy. And suddenly everybody's, and they're all belly laughing. Like, we're losing our minds, right? So I go back, I do 2 hours of rewrites. That's all that was ever changed. 2 hours worth of rewrites.
Wow.
I cut one scene. That's it.
Wow.
I then bring Brian in. Now, Brian was going to send us up to shoot the movie, right? With a production coordinator, but he wasn't going to come because he was going to be dealing with business in town. So I have him come and I want him to listen to the script. I don't want him to read it. I want him to listen to it. So he sits in for the reading, and he had told me after the reading, he had to go to a dinner. It's like, cool, do your thing. The reading ends. Brian says, excuse me for a minute. He goes outside the room. He comes back a couple minutes later. I said, are you okay? You got to go for your dinner? He goes, no, I just called them. I canceled that dinner.
Oh, wow.
Like, I'm not sending anybody up there with you to shoot this. I'm shooting this with you. That's like, so, I'm going to make this movie. And so we pre-produced in the month of December in Los Angeles. Now, anybody who knows production, pre-producing in December is a near impossible thing. But we did it. January, the first 2 weeks of January, we shot the movie. We shot 11 days, 11 nights, 1 day. So if you're keeping count on your clock, we put pen to paper October 31st, 2015. By January 14th, 2016, we were in the can. That's 10 weeks.
That's so crazy. Wow. Congrats on doing that.
Thank you. Thanks, man. And by the way, we shot the movie all in, and it's a union movie. Union actors, union writing, union producing. We shot the movie for $30,000.
Wow. I was going to ask you what the budget was, because it did feel, you know, very low budget because there's practical in there, but you can see the CGI, but it's mixed in well. So everything blends really well. And plus, it's a horror comedy, so it's kind of warranted to have, you know, goofy effects and stuff like that going on.
Yes. I mean, look, the first call I made when the script was finished is I called Bob Kurtzman, who was one of my closest friends for the last 30 years. I called him up and I said, listen, I have no money, but there's nobody I'm going to come to first. So I can totally understand if you say no, if you go, I can't do it, no way. I totally get it. But if you love it, come and do this and I'll make you a producer on the movie. And he was like, oh, for God's sakes, okay. And he called me 90 minutes later and was like, I'm in. I love this. And I said, hey, by the way, you want to shoot second camera for me? And then he said the funniest thing in the world to me. He said, dude, I feel like I should be paying you now. I was like, this is why we're brothers. This is it. So it's, you know, look, Secret Santa for me, it was the, you know, we have three divisions of the company. There's our high budget division, there's our television division, and then there's the what the hell happened to Roger Corman division.
Yeah.
And that's my favorite division of the company because it's the idea of like, look, you know, Roger Corman would give you a bologna sandwich and a ball of twine, but he'd let you go make your movie.
Yeah.
Make it in this much time, in this much money, but you get to make your movie. And I feel like there's nobody really supporting that anymore. I think A24 comes closest to it.
Yeah, for sure.
But still, the budgets are big. Those are big budgets. Yeah, yeah. And by the way, God bless them because they've become such a cachet studio that there's a panache to work with them so you can get big actors to come to do stuff for nothing. And that's helpful. Like, that's incredibly, like, you know, Bodies, 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 that doesn't get made without Pete Davidson.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
But it got made. And that's kind of the point. And it's so not what any other studio is doing. So I love them for that. I think that's great. I will also say it's kind of how we end up landing as far as, you know, North American release, because we've never released in this country. We've only done our DVD and Blu-ray, and we had some streaming through Amazon, but you had to buy it. We never went to Prime. We never did that. The reason we went to Screenbox is because, one, they had a minimum guarantee, which is unheard of now in our industry. And I go, like, how do you think filmmakers are going to survive? How do independent filmmakers make a living if no one's going to pay them? How does this work? Like, oh, I'm so lucky you showed my movie and made money for me. I'm so lucky. What? No. And Screenbox were wonderful. And moreover, they also loved the movie. They contacted us. They came to us. I never had to go to them. They wrote me an email and were like, hey, who owns the rights to Secret Santa? I was like, well, we do. Exclusively. Yeah. And they were like, great, because we love this movie. And they got it. Like, they just got the movie, you know? And it's it's not a PC movie at all. It really isn't.
No.
But you know what?
Very fun film, though.
Thank you, man. Well, look, I got to tell you that we, you know, we premiered the movie at Sitges, right? Sitges where it first showed. And then the very next screening was at Fright Fest Glasgow. Now, the amazing thing about that was that Sitges happens. I come back from Spain. I'm in my office, and I was writing, actually. And I get an email from Alan Jones. Now, do you know Alan?
I don't think so.
Okay. So Alan Jones is a UK critic. He's kind of the Roger Ebert of the UK.
Oh, yeah, I know who you're talking about now. Yes,
him and Mark Kermode are the big dogs. By the way, both raved about Secret Santa. They both gave us love letter reviews. But Alan wrote to me. The email I got was so beautiful and so effusive that I called my wife. I have an office downstairs from where I am right now, and she has an office two floors upstairs. I called her, and I was like, I need you to come down. And she was like, oh my God, what happened? I'm like, just come down. So she runs downstairs and like, I'm fully crying at my computer. And she's like, what happened? I said, yeah. So Deb comes over to the computer. She starts reading it. She starts crying.
Oh my God.
Like the greatest letter I've ever received, basically begging us to let him show it at Fright Fest Glasgow.
That's crazy.
And then it became the very first title that Fright Fest released in the UK.
That's
when they became a releasing company. It's the first one. So while they were showing it in Glasgow, I don't know, you would never have known this. This is an obscure fact, but the year we were showing it, which was 2018, it was March 2018, there was a snowstorm in England, literally not even an inch of snow. The entire country shut down. My entire team, my cast and crew are all in London and we cannot get to Glasgow. Oh, we can't take the train to Glasgow, okay? Because of this much snow. So we're stuck. Alan Jones is stuck as well, and it's his festival. He can't go, right? So Alan and my team, we all go to dinner at Gordon Ramsay's restaurant, in his restaurant called Steak in the middle of London. The reason we get into that is because one of our editors, Chris Kirkpatrick, cuts all of Hell's Kitchen. So he called Gordon Ramsay's people and got us into Steak, right? Wow. So that we would have like somewhere to go because we're all so upset that we couldn't be a thing. So I had sent a video to the festival to present the movie since I wasn't going to be there. So I rushed to make this video, and it's me in a close up about like this, lip syncing "Nothing Compares to You" by Sinead O'Connor.
Wow.
Okay. It got a standing ovation at the festival. Like, people were dying from laughter because it was like, I'm showing this movie at a horror festival. I need people to know it's a comedy. Like, I need them to know what we're doing. So I did that. Everybody's laughing their asses off. And suddenly the tweets start coming in while we're at dinner, right? And people like, Secret Santa and Skeleton Crew just owned Fright Fest with a pre-taped thing for the opening of the movie. By the end of the film, the tweets were like, it was amazing. But one tweet said, "Oh, great Fright Fest! Homophobia, xenophobia, hatred for Jews, all this whole list of stuff. Great work, Fright Fest. Really good choice for your top 10." Okay. Alan Jones shows it to me and he says, "I think this should be the quote on the poster." And I was like, "I think you're 100% right. I love it.
Yeah.
I love it." Because this person, right. I said, "This person clearly has no idea what our movie is." Like, I love when people are like, "The movie is, you know," and I'm like, "You do understand that the people in the movie all are going to be viciously murdered because they're terrible people, right? That is kind of the point of the story."
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, it's a movie that makes fun of everybody. I like to think of it as sort of in the vein of South Park in its comedy sense.
Yeah.
That nobody's safe. We're going to make fun of all of you.
Yeah, and it's another film where it's like, you can kind of relate to it, because like, my family's kind of like that. They're kind of dumb, you know? So it piggybacks on that. So it's super relatable. And once everybody starts dropping like flies and you see what's going on, you're like, you're fully into it. And, you know, hearing about like why they're doing this as a truth serum, which I think is so outrageous. Like, no one has ever like done something like that. I just put a bunch of serum in the drinks. Now everybody's going to essentially like burn from the inside out. I think it's ridiculously funny, and I love it so much. I'm so happy it's on Screenbox, and
thank you, brother.
I do a lot of work with them, reviewing movies and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And Alex, who's the one who got us in touch, is actually a really good friend of mine as well.
He's terrific. I was on with him for an hour and a half this morning. He's fantastic.
Yeah, he's
fantastic,
great. Fantastic
guy.
Yeah, he lives in Massachusetts where I live, so like, mm-hmm. we're pretty close, and like, we do a lot of things together. And he's always like, "Dude, you need to interview this person. You need to interview this one." And he said, "Hey, do you want to interview Adam?" And I was like, Yeah, who wouldn't? Come on, because like you've done so many awesome things, and to see where, well, hearing everything from where it all started to see where you are now, having mm-hmm. your own company, doing crazy films like Secret Santa, which everybody needs to go and watch on Screenbox or like anywhere else that you can get it right now. But I really highly recommend Screenbox because they really are a company for the fans and the creators. Like they support and they're always there for everybody. I can't say anything bad about them at all.
Because no, they're fantastic. Fantastic.
Their output monthly is crazy. The amount mm-hmm. of films that they get is crazy. And now that they're starting to do these other things with Fathom Events, which is the one night only like releases that they're doing with certain films, I think it's brilliant. You know, having another way to showcase these directors or creators mm-hmm. of their films for one night and to kind of get the theater experience before it's at home, I think is brilliant.
So it's great.
Absolutely great. Oh, but
yeah, I love them. I love them as a company, and I love the culture of the company. That's what's been so – that's why we said yes. We turned down a lot of people. Like a ton of people wanted this movie, and we're like, no.
Wow.
No, you just want – I don't want somebody who wants content. Oh, God. There's no word in the English language that kills a filmmaker's soul quicker than content. It's like, why don't you just call it a rivet? Why don't you just call it a coupling? Like, it's not an item. It's not a thing. It's a whole team's hard work over such a long period of time.
Yeah.
And you reduce it to content? No. No. Absolutely not. So they did not. They came to us as fans of the movie who knew the film well. Done. That means more to us than anything.
That's so awesome.
Yeah.
Adam, this has been such a great chat, just hearing about all your stories. And, you know, everybody always asks me sometimes, like, they always feel bad for me not asking a lot of questions. But my job as the host here is to hear you. So thank you for, like, literally running through every single question I have.
Oh, good. Oh, good.
Amazing stories. Because, like, it's people like you that make podcasting or just talking to people fun, you know, living in your life for a second and being like, wow. And also to inspire other creators out there, regardless of how, you know, big your budget is or whatever equipment you have, there's a way and a will to do it. And Adam right here just explained all of it. Thank you for being an inspiration to a lot of other people out there that will be listening to this, and also inspiring me to give franchises another chance and to, you know, realize like, okay, something different is good. You can't always have it the same way because it gets so stale and boring. Also for making a killer Christmas horror movie. I love Christmas horror movies, and I feel like there's not enough of them. Awesome. Some people say there are too many, but I think they're wrong. And to have one like yours that's so insane and batshit and over the top, low budget craziness
it is
amazing. So thank you so much for your time today and chatting, man.
Awesome, brother. This has been absolutely fantastic.
Hell yeah. And thank you to Alex and Screenbox and everybody there for hooking this up, because this was a very amazing time for me personally. Thank you guys so much. And
awesome.
Go support Adam and all his other films. I guess one last thing. Is there anything in the works right now that you can talk about?
Yeah, we, as the aforementioned documentary, Hearts of Darkness, The Making of the Final Friday, is in its last stages before release. We also have a fantastic movie we've been working on for a few years now that was brought to us by an incredible group of filmmakers, a company called Six with Heels Productions. Someone named Sarah Cheney and Heather Alt, and a writer named Lindsay Hollister, who brought us a project called Fat Camp Massacre, which Deborah and I joined the writing team on that. And now we're producing the film with them. Skeleton Crew is doing co-pro with them. That movie is will do for people of size what Get Out did for people of color.
Wow. Okay. That's very interesting.
It's crazy. It's really cool movie. You know, kind of tackles body dysmorphia and just sort of the last place that people somehow feel free to make fun of people. It's a really cool movie. So we've got that one going. I'm doing a political thriller called Domestic Terrorist that I'm shooting at the beginning of next year. And that is, that's an exciting, scary little project. I'm also Skeleton Crew, the low budget division, is doing about 7 new projects next year, all micro budget films, but really exciting voices and really cool movies. And Bob Kurtzman is returning to direct. And he's directing a film that Deb and I wrote called Hunting Season, which is a healthy mix of Bigfoot and Predator.
Yes, we need more
Bigfoot. Oh, dude, it's insane. It's such a batshit crazy awesome movie. And Bob is doing all the designs for the creatures as well as directing the film.
Wow.
So we're doing that next year as well. So yeah, there's a ton coming from this company. And it's just all it all comes from, again, you know, company culture, I think, is really important. I think that places have to have a sense of why they're there. And I always come from the place of, like, you know, George Romero and Toby Hooper, who, you know, people who think that Dawn of the Dead and Night of the Living Dead are about zombies, they're not paying attention.
It's so much more than that.
I mean, George Romero and Toby both made movies about the Vietnam conflict and about civil rights movement. And then George Romero told this incredible story of consumerism run amok. And everything he ever talked about has come true. So it's kind of incredible. Like, you know, and look, horror is the last place. It's the last bastion where we can keep pushing the envelope. There's so much in our world that we're not allowed to talk about anymore. This immediate sort of ending of conversations because somebody says something that somebody disagrees with.
Yeah.
And I think that's incredibly dangerous and harmful to our culture. And to that end, I'm trying to keep horror a place where we, as long as we give you that big scoop of ice cream that is gore and fun and nudity and craziness and all that good stuff, we can actually serve you a big plate of vegetables.
Yep.
So you're getting healthy, but you think you're eating dessert. And it's really about that. It's about, look, you know, and even from Jason Goes to Hell, you can tell, like, I am for casting that looks like our world. And that's all shapes, sizes, colors, sexual orientations, all of it. And I have put that flag down in 1993 when I made Jason Goes to Hell. I am still waving that flag, you know, 30 years later, because that's everything. And again, it shouldn't be political. Like, none of that should be political. That should just be like, oh, I would like to be a decent person that reflects the actual world around me in a positive way. Let's do that.
I'm right with you, man.
Let's do that. You know, so that's what Skeleton Crew is doing. And we are trying to honor that tradition in every project we're doing. And by the way, we're doing stuff that isn't horror. We're doing some comedies. We've got a great documentary series about the life of Doug Henning, the famous comedian, famous magician, excuse me. You know, we're doing a lot of really cool projects, but horror is where my heart is, and it always will be. So,
hell yeah, man. Well, you keep doing what you're doing with you and your team and your wife. I'm really excited for your future. This is definitely the age of where so many great voices are finally being heard. And, you know, a lot of great films are coming out because of everything that's going on in the world. You have to find that outlet. And horror, like we were just saying, is really the place you can do that. You can really do whatever you want. To some extent, but even then, people will find a way to do what they want regardless. Thank you so much, Adam, for being here.
You got it, brother. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, this was a great time. And wow. So thank you guys so much for listening and watching, and we will see everybody on the next one.